This teaching, the Maha Satipatthana Sutta, is the Buddha's teaching. It's his primary teaching on meditation. The contemplation, the four foundations of mindfulness. The teaching is direct, it's immediate, it's experiential, it's all-inclusive, it covers all aspects of our life experience. And its purpose, its sole purpose really, is to illuminate life, or to illuminate our life, to illuminate what it is that's really true. Now, in a way, everything that's happening is true. Whatever we see and hear and smell and touch and think and feel and remember and plan, and all that is the experience of life is true. What we're going to explore tonight, however, is what are called the Noble Truths. The teaching on the Four Noble Truths. As you may recall, or we could just review, touch again, foundations of mindfulness. First foundation is the body itself, the contemplation of the body as it truly is. Second foundation, contemplation of the feelings. Third foundation, contemplation of mind. Fourth foundation, contemplation of the dharmas, or mind objects. And within these dharmas, or mind objects, we have the Four Noble Truths. Many of us have heard this teaching. It's revered, it is shared, it is communicated, and it is experienced globally. It's around the world. The teaching is on all continents. This particular teaching was never uttered before on the planet Earth prior to the Buddha. This was the first teaching that he gave, the Four Noble Truths, when he came forth and spoke after the illumination, after his own emancipation. And he gave this teaching to his companions who had been traveling with him and practicing with him and living with him up to the point where they departed from one another. And as the story goes, it's very interesting because these characters, and they were probably quite eccentric, even among ascetics, they were very, you might say, austere and very, very extreme, because they were practicing austerities of basically starvation, self-mortification. And the Buddha was with these characters, these guys, and this is what they were up to. Even to this day, in parts of Asia and India, there are these views, there's these ideas that if you starve the body, or if you put the body, stand it in water up to the neck and let the water rush past it, on and on and on and on, you can wash out that which is defiled, that which is impure, that which is in the way of illumination. Quite extreme in a way, yes? And there's other views, even to this day, that some people are entertaining globally, that if you can acquire the very best for yourself, if you can get everything just so, if you can get into the perfect state of consciousness, get perfectly concentrated, get your act together completely, and this will bring illumination. Both of these views are, you might say, extreme. Over here, self-mortification, severe asceticism, total, you might say, attempt at renunciation. And over here, an indulgence, a full, you might say, immersion in a realm or a quality of pleasure, of blissfulness. Now, the Buddha had seen this world of pleasure. He'd seen this world. He'd been brought into this world. He was raised in this world Whereas the legend goes, his father, the ruler of the kingdom of that time in that area where he lived, had big plans for him. He was going to have him take over, take the helm, and be the leader of not only this kingdom, but many other kingdoms. It was very distressing to their father to discover, when they took this concern they had about what was going to happen to this young son, who was to become the Buddha, to the most important, and you might say revered astrologer in the community, and they presented the information and they asked the astrologer to go at it and do his work and come up with what's going to happen. A beautiful teaching came out there, and the astrologer said, if this son of yours is to stay with that which you wish for him, he'll become the ruler of not only this kingdom, but many others. However, if he does not, he'll become the ruler of the world. Now, this was a riddle in a way for the father. He was distressed by this. What does that mean? He felt as if something that he deeply wanted and deeply desired was potentially slipping from his grip. It was most important to him. Most important thing that could happen was that his son take over in his place. And not only that, but multiply. Make it better. Do what I have done and make it even better. So he had a lot of anxiety coming up. As it went, though, you see, we must really understand the power of destiny or fate. The power of that which is moving through these very body-mind processes right now that we cannot understand with our intellect. Sometimes it manifests as duty. Duty gets a bad rap sometimes. But we know the duty of the parent. We know the duty of the teacher. We know the duty of the fireman. The duty of the friend. The duty of the lover. What would be the duty of the ruler of the world? So as it so happened, having been raised in this opulent situation, the best clothes, best food, best music, best literature, best, there was great unhappiness, though, even there in the family of the Buddha. There was interpersonal strife. It was stress. There was something moving very deep within him, which was, what is this stress? What is this unhappiness? These clothes, this food, this environment, this palace, this sexuality, all of it. It doesn't resolve this stress. And maybe even, in some ways, it adds to it. I must understand. So the legend has it that he snuck out, which he wasn't supposed to do, you see, because his father wanted to make sure that he did not see what was beyond the palace walls, because he felt if he saw what was beyond the palace walls, it would affect his son's consciousness and alter the father's plan for his son, that he'd lose control of him. So he snuck out nonetheless in the night. He had one of the chariot drivers take him out into the countryside outside the palace. And he had then the revelation, you might say, the revealing to him of the four heavenly messengers, as it's been called throughout the thousands of years the teachings have been given. He saw an old person. He'd never seen an old person. As his father kept him from that, removed all the old people. Get him away so my son won't see them. He saw an old person. He asked the chariot driver, "What is that?" The chariot driver said, "That is an aging person. That happens to everybody." What would you feel like if you'd never seen that before? And you were an adult. And you saw this. What would you feel or think? Went on a little further. And there was a very sick person by the side of the road. He asked the chariot driver, "What is that?" "Never seen that before. Father had kept all the sick people away. Get him away. Don't let my son see this." The chariot driver said, "This is a person with disease. This happens to everybody." How would you feel if you've never seen that before? And there it was right before your eyes. What would you think? What would you feel? What would you want to do? Went on a little further. And there was a corpse. We cover them up, we move them away. So had his father done this? "What is that?" "That is a corpse. That is a dead body. That happens to everybody." "Wow, what about that one?" That was the third heavenly messenger. And then the fourth, a little further. And there was a monk sitting under a tree meditating in stillness, in solitude, in contemplation. And he asked the chariot driver, "What is that?" "That is a renunciate, a mendicant. That is a person who has devoted their life to understanding the truth." These four heavenly messengers, as they were spoken about over the thousands of years since that happened, you might say, pierced into the soon-to-be historical Buddhist consciousness, could not be forgotten. And so he went back into the palace. We perhaps will never know exactly how many days passed, perhaps not very long, but once again in the middle of the night, he went in and he kissed his wife and child goodbye for now. And he left because he needed to find an answer to that which he could not understand, and no one he knew could give him the answer to his question. What is the truth? These circumstances that I have observed, this life of opulence, this life of stress amidst the opulence, these human bodies that I have seen that have revealed to me something that I do not understand, what is the cause of this unhappiness around me and in me? And is there a solution? Is there a way out? I gotta know. 29 years old. This is what was happening. So he went on a search. He went on a pilgrimage. He went and he studied with everyone he could find who understood, or at least he thought understood, the truth of these kinds of problems, these kinds of circumstances. And he wanted to find, is there a freedom that is beyond these circumstances? Is there an emancipation? Is there a liberation? Is there a way out of this circumstance? Or must we all be subject to what I have seen with my very eyes? Are you compelled by that as well? You might say, every fiber of his being was compelled by this. It took roughly 6 years before he sat under the Bodhi tree, having gone all the way through every practice and teaching that he could find that was available, and seeing something there but not what would really deeply and surely answer his concern or his questions, he finally found the middle way. And that's when he left his companions. And he took some food from the milkmaid, and it actually so happened that his companions left him. Because they said, he's lost his resolve, he's lost his commitment, he's not holding to the self-mortification, he's taken food from the milkmaid, let's leave him. And if you look at some of the statues or the depictions of his body from that particular time historically, he was so thin you could see his backbone from right through here. Not the big chunky Buddhas with the big cheeks and the bellies that we see over there in Japan. He got much fatter by the time he got to Japan. And started to smile. No, he's a skeleton. He's barely got any flesh. It's mostly just bone with very little skin bag hanging on it. So the key, yes, the key that he found was the power of contemplation, the power of non-interfering awareness. That awareness, that non-interfering contemplation is present right here, right now. Notice it amongst us and within us. You might say we're sitting in the bubble of it. Because it's deeply personal. It's deeply interpersonal. And it's radiantly transpersonal simultaneously. And under that Bodhi tree, as the legend has it, and it is a legend, not just a story, he sat and vowed not to move. And he was ready not to move. This room was pretty still tonight. Did you notice there was a lot of stillness in this room? A lot of non-movement. So he was ready not to move at all. Not to move a muscle until the deliverance, until the piercing through of that which appeared to be true, which was that he too was subject to those very things that he saw that night that the four heavenly messengers came. The aged, the disease, the death. And what about that renunciate? What does that symbolize? All these things had been working deeply for many years. Maybe the destiny of fate had it working somewhere, even in his child consciousness. These things we'll never know. We can imagine, though, perhaps. So coming out of this Bodhi tree meditation, the work was done. emancipation occurred the moment of dawn, when the sun rose. You might have called that, and fairly so, an extremely arduous journey. Take it all the way to the point of almost death through starvation in the name of freedom. So what do you do now? Well, what he did is he hung around the tree for about 2 weeks in total adoration for the tree. Imagine that. The tree that he sat under, sat beside, he adored for 2 weeks. Now what? Throughout the centuries, human beings awaken, and sometimes they walk away. Lao Tzu walked away, gave a teaching, and then disappeared into the mist. Jesus gave a teaching, and in a certain sense, disappeared through a crucifixion. The Buddha could have disappeared into the Umayyas very easily. Many people had just gone up into the mountains and enjoyed, fully enjoyed, the liberation beyond the world of opposites, beyond the world of pleasure and pain, because he found the deathless. He found that which doesn't die. He found the unconditioned. He became the unconditioned. But fate or destiny or dharma, the truth of the way things really are, you could say maybe he had another plan. And so as he was walking, it is said that another kind of heavenly messenger came in the form of a deva. A deva is like an angel. And the deva spoke to him and said, "Teach the Dharma for those with little dust in their eyes." And now he knew what to do with the rest of his life. And he knew who to go to straight away. He went to his companions who had served him, who had helped him, and finally abandoned him. And he went straight to them. And what did he have to say? When he walked into the grove where they were staying and walked up to them, they immediately saw this man has been transformed. And they sat and awaited what he had to say. And what came forth from his mouth was the first teaching that set in motion in this world the wheel of Dharma, this world of the mind-body process, until it is seen for what it really is, not what you think it is. What you think it is you. When the body-mind process is seen for what it really is, the wheel of Dharma appears out of the wheel of samsara. The wheel of samsara is the wheel of perpetual wandering. It's human beings wandering about. Even as they feel, they know who they are and what they're doing and why they're doing it. That is the wheel of samsara. Much of what happens in the mind is the wheel of samsara. The word samsara means perpetual wandering. It's a fine wandering, is it not? Strolling about, buying our food, saying hello, having people tailgate us. It happened to me this morning. It was great. And just between you and me, I shared this earlier today, I'll get it out one more time, I gave her the finger. Which agitated her even more, and I felt increased sense of danger up my backside. It was just so fun to just feel the energy come off that middle finger. And just between you and me, it wasn't a heavy-duty one. It was just gentle. It was a gentle touch. Anyways, I got away without a bruise to the bumper and fresh sense of sensation coming through. Was that her anger or mine? Or was it shared? Who cares? Who knows? And so we go through the moments we do. Sometimes wondering, sometimes not. What's it all about? And maybe we don't just feel the humor of the question, but we actually sense the sincerity and depth of the unknowing of what is this answer to this question? What is it all about, truly? The wheel of Dharma was set in motion out of, amidst, through, beyond the wheel of samsara when the Buddha gave the teaching to his companions on the Four Noble Truths. A noble truth is a truth that has the power to liberate or to illuminate the life of us humans. I've not found yet for myself that the carrots, organic as they may be, in my vegetable drawer are somehow yet embodying the noble truths yet. And thus I call them the truth of the carrot, the truth of the automobile, the truth of the tree, the truth of the sofa, the truth of the employment or non-employment, the truth of the truth and the truth and the truth of this and that and this and that and this and that. Interesting thing, and I hope you'll see it, is that the noble truths, just like the wheel of Dharma coming up through the wheel of samsara, the wheel of Dharma is coming through the carrots. It is coming through the bumpers. It is coming through the anger. It is coming through the employment, the unemployment, the money, the less money, the more money. It's coming through everything that's happening that you call even a not noble truth. This is the turning. First noble truth. Succinctly. See, the Buddha is shooting straight. He's not pulling any punches. First noble truth. Life is suffering. Not an ultimate truth, yet it's an existential truth. Not pejorative, not pessimistic, not negative at all. If we don't get savvy, smart, graceful, and intelligent about the first noble truth, life is suffering, we will be imprisoned. Suffering. I'm going to be very clear about this because we're going to stay with this truth even as we talk a little bit about the others. Tonight's talk is about the first noble truth. Don't forget, when the Dalai Lama was in London some years back, he gave a 2-week discourse, 2 weeks, on the Four Noble Truths. We'll see if we can just do a little justice to one of them in 20 minutes. We have to leave a little early tonight. There's a guest coming here into the house, and we want to clear out by 9, like good doobies. Second noble truth is that there is a cause for the suffering. There is a cause for the suffering. Rational, scientific, pragmatic, objective, discernible, experienceable, definitive. Third noble truth, there is cessation of suffering. There is dissipation, dissolution, falling away, extinction. There is emancipation from suffering. There is deliverance. There is liberation. There is freedom. Fourth noble truth, there is a way to live. There is a way to move. There is a way to be and become, because we are both being and becoming. Can you see it? Being and becoming. They misnamed us just slightly at the beginning when they called us human beings. Whoever they were, we are human becomings and also human beings. And if we're not careful, we become a little too much into the doing. We lose touch with the being, and now we're human doings. That's why it's very interesting, the Mare healers. When they ask someone like that typical, how you doing? They don't say it like that. They say, how you be? Or, if they want to get a little more of a slide on it, they say, how you being? Feel where that goes? How you being as opposed to how you doing? There was a way to live so that the first, second, and third noble truth are realized. Not intellectually understood only, not felt, not sensed, but realized. What does that mean? You become the noble truths. It's that intimate. Actually, you already are that. But awakening means you come to truly know it. So I'm going to read out of the sutra itself right now. I was looking at this before coming over, and my son said to my wife, take the cookbook away from Dad. I'm just going to read this because it's really good. So, this is just a piece of the sutra. It's just one paragraph. And it's being delivered to the community of monks. So don't get caught on the word monk. And what, monks, is the noble truth of suffering? First noble truth. Response. Birth is suffering. Aging is suffering. Death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress are suffering. Being attached to the unloved is suffering. Being separated from the loved is suffering. Not getting what one wants is suffering. In short, the five aggregates of grasping are suffering. Five aggregates, you might recall: body, feeling, mental formations, perceptions, and consciousness. When these are grasped at, this is suffering. Let me read it again. And what, monks, is the noble truth of suffering? Birth is suffering. Aging is suffering. Death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress are suffering. Being attached to the unloved is suffering. Being separated from the loved is suffering. Not getting what one wants is suffering. In short, the five aggregates, when grasped at, are suffering. Okay. You relate to that? See how that works? what's being said there is quite upsetting for people sometimes, is that the actual truth of you coming here as a body-mind process, having the experience of birth itself, is suffering. And then everything that follows after that, as it's described in the paragraph, but it begins with birth. That sounds pretty life-negating. Does it not? Does the mind go, well then, maybe we should just not be born? But what's that? What would I be attempting to talk about if there was no birth? But look at it carefully. If there was no birth, there would be no dying. There would be no death. And what's in between birth and death? If we're not very savvy, very curious, very awestruck, as the Buddha was, by many things as he journeyed, we will spin in the wheel of samsara from birth to death, with moments and maybe a day, maybe a week even if you're lucky, where you don't feel too much uncomfortableness, where the body doesn't hurt too much, where your mind behaves a little bit more, where your food digests a little bit easier, where everything seems to be a little more smooth, but it doesn't last, does it? Why? Because nothing lasts. Nothing stays the same. Everything keeps changing. And grasping at that which is constantly changing, clinging to that which is constantly changing, now we're getting close to the cause for the unhappiness, the suffering, the distress, the lamentation, the pain, the friction, the stress. There's much that can be said about life that appears to be not of suffering. The celebrations, the parties, the youthfulness, the twinkle in the eye of the wise elders, the babies coming in, their unselfconscious giggling. Somebody had, what's the number for seven? Sextuplets? Sextuplets?
Septuplets.
This woman has seven babies. And then I get an email of a video of her with the seven babies, and the dad has figured out how to get all these kids to laugh in unison. And they're lying there like a spread. They're like spread out. There's four on one side of the mother and three on the other. And they look a lot the same. Sextuplets. Anyways. And they're laughing together as a chorus. And the dad has some way, he's in the background, of figuring out how to get these kids to laugh. And then he would do it, and then they would settle down, and then he'd do it again, and they'd burst up again, and he just went on and on. A lot that we can say, oh, that's so beautiful, that's so cute, that's so wonderful, that's so much fun. I don't like the sound of this suffering stuff. This is pessimistic, this is negative. this is a Buddhist dark alley. All I can tell you in one sense at the moment is that some of the monks that I've met, they really have looked like dark alleys. But some of the monks that I've met are the happiest people I've ever met. Like the one who popped into a retreat once. It was freezing cold. It was about 10 degrees in New England in the middle of the winter. And everybody in the meditation center is bundling up. They're walking around with jackets and hoods on indoors. Because when you're meditating, sometimes you get so like thin, you feel really thin, and you stop wanting to eat so much, and you just kind of eat a little bit, and you get really simple, and you start walking very slow, and you hear vegetarian music in your mind. I won't sing such a song because I don't know how to sing vegetarian music, but it exists. And this monk shows up amidst this freezing cold meditation retreat, and he's got his robes, and he is barefoot. And people are like, I've got two layers of the warmest socks on that I have, and I'm walking around and I'm still cold. And he's there, and he's crossed his legs, and he's hanging out, and we're having a little talk. And I noticed that when he turned his head, I always was interested in, like, are people's necks tight or loose? And I always felt everybody's neck is tight. Mine sure is. And he would, like, move his head, and it just looked like it was, he could just turn it around. It was so loose. And everything that came out of him was just so loose. Then he got up in front of us to give a Dharma talk. Very noble, sitting up straight. And everybody's ready to go. Hear the Dharma talk, and he pulls out a book, and maybe it's the sutras, we think. Yes, it's the sutras. He's going to read from the sutras. It's a chocolate cake recipe from Adele Davis, The Joy of Cooking. I'm way in the back, and I think I'm hearing a sutra. Yes, and then you blend in the butter. And this laughter starts to spread. It starts at the front of the meditation center and just going back through the hall. It's rippling back, and slowly it dawns on me. This is the joy of cooking Adele Davis' chocolate cake recipe. I know this from my childhood. That was the Dharma talk. He read this. He read the recipe for the chocolate cake, and he got up and he walked out. This is with a group of people who've been meditating for 2 months. Been hearing about this stuff and that and this and that. A lot to celebrate, isn't it? The funny, the lightness, the party. And it's fun to get what you want. Sometimes it's not that bad when you don't get what you want, and even when you definitely get what you don't want. It's okay. I can handle it. I think I'm all right still. It's okay when they love you. It's okay when they don't. I'm okay. I'm making it. I still don't know where the hell I'm going, but I'm making it. And there's death. As the Yaqui Indian sorcerer Don Juan said to Carlos Castaneda, death is always over your left shoulder. Oh yeah, he already had his own version of the First Noble Truth coming through there. It's ephemeral, isn't it? It's ephemeral, transitory situation. In your contemplation, in your looking deeply, and you're not taking somebody else's opinion or experience as your truth, lo and behold, you begin to see, because everything is transitory, because nothing lasts, nothing can bring lasting happiness. And so your mind might go, I guess there isn't any lasting happiness. I guess I'll do the best I can. Won't try to hurt anybody. Won't give too many people the finger. I'll be as kind as I can. Won't use too much of the resources. I'll live a good life. And I'll die. I'll find out what happens then. Maybe I'll carry a theory right up to that point. What am I in control of and what am I not in control of? What's truly worthy of my attention? When the wheel of Dharma emerges in the flow of your life stream, for some it's very difficult to not pay rapt attention, undivided. Full. So you look, perhaps any way you can, to see for yourself. What is this suffering that, unfolding as it is, unrelenting as it is, amidst the stream of the transitory ephemeralness, the bubbles of life experience, if it doesn't last, it can't bring a lasting happiness. And I or me or you or we wanting a lasting happiness is just more suffering. What do I do? I can't figure this out. This is the ultimate riddle. I can't do anything. I can't think anything. I can't feel anything. I can't talk about anything that fundamentally connects with a satisfactory response to the question, is there a lasting happiness? But I can't not look either. I can't just go through the motions in a sleep trance. It's too painful to try to go back and be as I was. Even if I try to go back and be as I was when I was very happy in that picture. Yes, I was happy. Everything was working. My neck was loose. I had more control over my desire for chocolate. Plug in whatever you like there. It's all pertinent in your personal storyline. I can have so much fun talking about this. Part of the reason is because you're here. Part of the reason is because the most interesting thing may be that which you can't comprehend with your mind, but won't let your heart go. Hold your heart's attention. People get it messed all up at times, this truth of suffering, and they're going to try to not be an attached, clinging, grasping person. They're going to renounce. They're going to simplify. They're going to unload. And then they're a simplified, renounced, unloaded, attached person. What starts to shine through, slow but sure, until it pops, is that yes, there is suffering, but there's actually no one who is actually suffering. Yes, there is unsatisfactoriness, and yet there is no one who is actually dissatisfied. And when you think, feel, and believe you're the one that is dissatisfied, then you must be the one who believes, I need satisfaction. And thus, there you ride between those two, the dissatisfaction and the hope, the dream, the imagination, the projection of satisfaction. It's the same person in a way. The tussle and the turn and the sheets wrapped around your leg. They started out straight, and when I awoke, they were wrapping. This samsaric wheel wrapped the sheet around the leg, the arm, the torso. Sometimes kind of tight, have you noticed? Somehow, mysteriously, we've bought the idea that we're the ones that are suffering. We're the ones that are experiencing the unsatisfactory. We're the ones that need the satisfactory. And if you didn't feel that you were the one who needed the unsatisfactory, then why would you bother looking? For something deeper or more profound or true or refined or more noble. Why would you be interested in the noble truths at all? But your seeking of that satisfactory, have you noticed? It falls short over and over and over and over. And your attempts to remove the unsatisfactory have fallen short over and over and over and over. And so perhaps this most sublime riddle goes on, playing out its tune, singing itself through your very thoughts and feelings and actions. And yet, the noble truth of suffering, the noble truth that life has suffering in it, the noble truth that life is unreliable, unpredictable, and immeasurably mysterious, resonates, that truth resonates, it resonates, it resonates, it resonates. It gets right into the cells. And lo and behold, the cause for this suffering, grasping, clinging, and holding, and the centrality of that grasping and clinging and holding is to the idea, the sense, the view that you are a body-mind process, and you are suffering. There's the suffering. The clinging, the grasping at that view or perception that you are that. And saying you're not will not emancipate you. Increasing the suffering as some people do, intensifying it, dive into the darkness further, dive into tantric, blend the wrestlers in the ring right now, tonight, beating the crap out of one another for money. I used to watch that as a young boy. My parents would occasionally come in and say, "This is too violent," and turn off the television. And they were not very strict in some ways, but then they would leave, and I would pretend as if I had found interest in other things, but I was thinking about that headlock and that guy doing this on the other guy's head, and I would look for the chance to go back in and turn it on again. Watch some more of that. What am I doing? I don't even know. It's just what's happening, and I'm interested. It's more interesting than pancakes. And it's even better to have pancakes and wrestling at the same time. A rare event. And so we figure out we'll let go. We need to let go of this talk in a minute, but we'll let go. I'll let go, I'll lay back. I won't cling, I won't grasp, and therefore I won't suffer. I'll let life flow because I'm a flow, right? I'm a flow, I'm a flute, I'll let it happen. I won't hold on. But then my dream appears, my day-night dream appears, and in the dream of the night, I'm grasping again. I'm struggling again, I'm pushing and pulling. I'm wrestling. I'm running. I'm confused. I'm scared. I'm lonely. I'm angry. And I wake up with the sting of it. Have you noticed? And if the dream was very deep and there was absorption, I'm relieved to wake up into the daydream. See, this is a dream. No more, no less than the night dream. Why? Because this is made of the same ingredients. Slightly different composition. Five aggregates unfolding. Body, feeling, mental formation, consciousness, perception. That's what's happening in the dream of the nighttime. That's what's happening now. And so, even as you attempt to let go, let it all go. I'll just be so still, I won't move a muscle. I'll sit under my own Bodhi tree. I'm just not sure I'll sit until the full emancipation happens, because that could take a while. I'll try it for an hour. With group support. Awaiting the bell after 15 minutes because my knee is... So we can to feel, know, really get clear about what is it that is happening that I am identified myself as that's hurting here. And you begin to get it. It begins to get clear that there's something going on in there like a fist holding. Little fist, bigger fist, medium size. There's a holding. Okay, I'll relax the holding. But still I don't know what I am. I don't know who I am. got to come back next week for some more.